Welcome to the Information Security Forum podcast. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. Our guest on today's podcast episode is Christopher Friends, AVP of Information Security for Interfaith Medical Center, where he has worked to develop the hospital's information security program and infrastructure. ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin sat down with Chris to talk about how and why Interfaith implemented a zero-trust network security model, tips for getting business leaders on board with cybersecurity plans, overcoming the challenges of working in an environment with legacy devices, and more.
So Chris, thanks very much for coming along. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Sure. I'm the AVP of Information Security for Interfaith Medical Center, which is a hospital in Brooklyn, New York. And I've run the Information Security program there for about 7 years now.
Excellent. So, I mean, Interfaith, I understand, is one of the first hospitals in the country to embrace a zero-trust model for network security. Can you just explain for our listeners what that actually means? What is a zero-trust model? What's
sure.
it all about?
Zero-trust is basically when you put a firewall in front of every device and you only allow network communications that are explicitly needed and nothing else. And we got the idea to go down the zero trust road back in 2015. I'm a very big proponent of constantly testing security, trying to see what works, what doesn't work. And one of the things we did back in 2015 was I simulated a mass malware outbreak within the hospital.
Okay.
So for those unfamiliar with it, one of the things we did is we used the ICAR test string. And what that is it's a harmless string of characters, but years and years ago, all the AV makers got together and agreed to treat this harmless string of characters as a virus. So it provided a safe but effective way to test how a virus could spread through the organization. So I approached it by writing a Perl script that took this ICAR test string and attempted to copy it to every PC within the organization to kind of simulate how a malware could spread through our hospital. And it was a really interesting exercise. It really demonstrated what controls worked for us, what controls didn't work, highlighted areas for improvement, things like that. And one of the controls that stood out as being very effective was that of network segmentation. We had network segmentation in place at the time, but one of the interesting things was is the exercise showed that even though the network was segmented, it probably wasn't segmented to a fine-grained enough manner in order to actually be effective against a ransomware attack. Because in a hospital, at the time, we were segmented by department. And yes, having it restricted to one department is great, but losing a radiology department or another critical department would still have an unacceptable impact on patient care.
Right.
So that kind of got us thinking about how we could take network segmentation to the next level. And we began to go down the road to zero trust.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, let's dig into that in a little bit more detail there, because, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about a hospital environment, and you've mentioned, you know, some of the, I suppose, larger scale, you know, computers and infrastructure that you've got. And I think I can see how you can segment that. But if we then move into the realm of things like medical devices, tablets, you know, all of that sort of thing that's being used within the hospital environment, how do you go about enabling that zero trust environment when you have all of those other, maybe not peripheral devices, but certainly other things that are complicating the issue, right?
Yes, it's definitely a challenge, and it was a time-consuming process. We started the journey shortly after we did the simulated incident back in 2015, and we began with the data center, although you could make an equally valid case for starting with the endpoints and then moving to the data center secondarily.
Right.
But we began the journey in the data center. For that, we used the VMware NSX product, and we actually used that to micro-segment our data center. How we approached it is, first, we actually took an inventory of all of the stuff on our network. So that was a challenge. We actually went ahead and we mapped out everything, figured out every device we had in their network, where they were connected, things like that. The second challenge, and actually the biggest challenge of going to zero trust, was actually once we had that inventory of all the devices on the network, was actually figuring out how all those devices actually communicated with each other.
Right.
So what systems were sending data to what other systems. And that turned out to actually be the biggest challenge. That was the most difficult part of the process, but also the most important part of the process, because if you got that right, you knew what rules to put in place for your zero trust architecture, because those identified traffic flows, those form the basis of the traffic you're going to allow, and everything else becomes blocked by default.
Right.
So we actually spent the most time mapping out how actually the systems talk to each other. And that was probably the biggest challenge of approaching that. Once we understood how the systems actually talk to each other. Then we put the rules in place to actually implement the zero trust. And we began doing that by doing the most well-known like servers and services first, mm-hmm. things like DHCP, DNS, things that are pretty standard. Every network admin knows the ports and protocols off the top of their head.
Right.
That was a twofold reason. One, with each thing we segmented and protected, we improved the security. But at the same time, because they were easy, low-hanging fruit, it allowed our staff to actually learn the NSX product at the same time. So it was a way to actually learn while at the same time improving security somewhat. Once we were kind of comfortable with the NSX product, we began to move on to our virtual desktop environment. Mm-hmm. Reason for that is most virtual desktops tend to be clones of each other.
Right.
So once we figured out one set of policies that worked for a desktop, we're able to roll those out to a large number of virtual desktops and protect a pretty good number of machines with not too much effort. From there, we moved on to the systems that we considered high risk in our environment.
Okay.
And we saved the low risk but complex systems for last. And we approached it slowly so we didn't break anything. So that was something that we were very concerned with. Mm-hmm. So we did this over the matter of probably 18 months okay. to actually secure all the servers in the data center. So for the server side, we used a VMware NSX for the micro-segmentation. For the more physical network, we actually took the approach of using a NAC appliance. Mm-hmm. So what we did for that is we put policies in the NAC appliance that basically allowed communications by device type. So PCs got one particular profile that allowed certain communications. Printers got another. Security cameras got another. And the NAC really worked well for anything for which there was a large number of those types of devices on the network. Mm-hmm. So for PCs, for example, we have policies in place that allow a PC to communicate with our server subnet, which is in turn micro-segmented with NSX,
right.
but that PC cannot communicate with anything else. Mm-hmm. So no two PCs in my environment can actually communicate with each other.
Okay.
There's no lateral movement possible between them. They can only communicate with that server subnet, and the NSX product ensures that they can only see the servers that they need to see and nothing else. So we kind of use the two solutions to work together to form that zero trust approach. Mm-hmm. We also do have some small internal firewalls, things like that, for some of the one-off devices, things like MRI machines. Even big hospitals don't have too many of them. And the NAC didn't really wasn't an effective approach for that. So we did some small firewalls for that. We also use a lot of internal firewalling to control traffic flowing between subnets. So to provide some IPS functionality to our servers, things like virtual patching for some of the medical devices. And that's kind of the overall approach that we took towards implementing Zero Trust.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that you've been talking about, of course, is infrastructure-based. So
yes.
From a user standpoint, there isn't any disruption that goes on here. Did you have to work with end users? When we talked about securing endpoints, you mentioned the MRI machines and so on. Were users involved in any way with some of this?
We always alerted them that we were doing it because in case any issues arise, we wanted to know right away so we could reverse it and fix it.
Right.
But issues are relatively minor. For the most part, as long as you really spend a lot of emphasis on that step two, learning how the systems actually communicate with each other. If you do adequate work there and actually put the time in to really ensure that you have everything mapped out properly, the breakage is actually fairly minimal, if non-existent.
So you've got the zero trust model. Anybody listening to this, imagine there's a CISO listening to this, maybe not even in the same environment as the one you've just been describing. And they think, I'd really like to transition to that sort of model. What would your advice be? Where would they begin? Because you've obviously trialed this, you've rolled it out effectively. So what sort of advice would you give to a CISO listening as to how they could in turn begin to roll out a similar zero trust model in their environment?
Sure. I would actually begin with a risk assessment. Identify what in your environment actually needs the most protection, what needs to be segmented.
Right.
Maybe it's certain legacy devices you have. Maybe certain devices are more critical than others that they stay protected. So I would actually start with a risk assessment and identify what actually in your environment is most in need of protection. What do you need to isolate most? Like, for example, in a hospital, in a lot of cases, it's medical devices mm-hmm. because medical devices don't just pose a risk to patient information, but they also pose a risk to patient safety if
right.
they're compromised. So it will somewhat vary by industry, but I would definitely start with the risk assessment to identify what in your environment you actually need to secure, mm-hmm. what you need to put the emphasis on.
Okay. And then gradually build it from there. So you're not trying to sort of boil the ocean here. It's little bite-sized chunks that you're
basically, that's largely why we did it over the course of so many months is we wanted to minimize breakage but at the same time protecting stuff. Because in the hospital, downtime is really not acceptable. So we had to be very careful actually deploying this.
Okay. I'm curious as well as to how did you sell the concept of this sort of 18-month program to the board of the hospital or whoever it is? I mean, who did you have to convince to be able to move down this road first of all? Let's start there.
did have to convince other executives on the hospital staff, but that's largely where the mock incident came in, because it actually concretely showed what the impact would be if we were to be hit with a ransomware attack.
Okay.
So it kind of is fairly convincing when you see that, yes, we have a lot of the standard controls in place, which was the network segmentation by department at the time, which is actually better than a lot of hospitals had back in 2015. Mm-hmm. But even so, it showed that the risk was really unacceptable because you couldn't afford to lose a whole department. The impact on patient care would be fairly disastrous.
Right. So effectively, you're creating a scenario that the business owners, if I could put it that way, can relate to.
Yes.
And so you're making the case that way. And then, of course, they can decide whether or not that's acceptable or not acceptable. And in this particular instance that you mentioned, clearly it wasn't acceptable to have that kind of of scenario. Okay. So I think that's probably quite a useful and indeed important takeaway for people listening to this, because very often I'm asked, where do I begin? How do I get the message across to the business? You know, from a security standpoint, I can understand that I need to be putting a security wrapper around certain devices, networks, and so on. But the challenge very often is, how do you sell that up to the executives who perhaps haven't seen, you know, the potential downside? And so I think that's a really good insight there.
Yes, and that's always a challenge, because for any environment, but that's part of why being a good CISO also involves a lot of soft skills.
Right.
You need the ability to kind of teach and present and get people to understand your point of view and where you're coming from and what the risks actually are.
And how much of your time do you spend on that sort of soft skill transfer, if you like, and trying to get your message across?
Quite a bit, actually, both within my hospital as well as speaking to other hospitals. I also speak at a lot of conferences, things like that. Basically, working to improve security in healthcare is a pretty important goal of mine, not just with my own hospital, but within healthcare in general. So I've done a lot of work in that area. I did the OWASP Secure Medical Device Deployment Standard. I've run the AHIS Incident Response Committee, which we put out a lot of guidance for hospitals on how to respond to and deal with incidents, including actually the simulated malware incident I mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's actually documentation on the AHIS website that actually walks you through the whole process I did. So if any other hospitals or organizations want to repeat it, that is available as public guidance.
Right. And we've touched on, you know, ransomware a few times in this conversation already, but we continue to see ransomware attacks being carried out against hospitals, not just here in the United States, but in other parts of the world, Australia, for instance, being one as well, where there's been some fairly major attacks in the last few months. What is the sort of advice that you would give to, be it hospitals or other organizations, that are hit by a ransomware attack?
You talk about preparing for the ransomware attack or to respond to it?
Both.
Okay. To prepare, I'm definitely a big proponent of testing. As I said, I'm very, very big on testing security. Have people actually do pen tests, do assessments to see what your weaknesses are, see what you can do to actually remediate it. Drill the incident response process as well. One of the things that's critical if any incident hits you is how quickly your staff can respond. And that's one of the other great things about the simulated incident we did and some other simulated incidents we've done over the years, is that it actually tests the staff's response as well.
Right.
You don't want to find you one of those organizations who thinks they had great backups but never tested a restore, and suddenly you find out that all the data you thought you had backed up actually wasn't. So you want to test all that kind of stuff in advance. So really drilling the incident response process, testing to see, make sure your security is actually effective. I mean, everybody makes mistakes. You could have a great high-end security appliance or other thing, but if you didn't configure it right, it's going to be a problem.
Right.
So testing that kind of stuff ahead of time helps you eliminate all of those issues. It also helps identify weaknesses that you can put other controls in to remediate. So a very, very big proponent of testing security to actually see what works and what doesn't work.
Okay.
In terms of the response, too, once again, I think the testing is really effective, because the more you drill those scenarios, the better your staff are going to be at detecting the incident, the better they're going to be at responding to it, the better the incident's going to be mitigated. So actually drilling and testing to see how well you could stand up against an attack is one of the big things that I'm a proponent of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're rehearsing, we're practicing for the day that we hope doesn't actually come. But that doesn't stop ransomware attacks hitting hospitals. And I suppose that's one of the biggest concerns that a lot of us do have, because there are very few, as a proportion, you know, elective procedures. If you're going in for an elective procedure, then okay, it can be annoying if it's delayed. But I suppose it's much more the concern around the emergencies that are having to be shuffled off to perhaps a different hospital or delayed. And so there is a potential, as you pointed out, to, you know, safety comes into it in a fairly major way. So if a hospital is hit by a ransomware attack, talk me through how you would advise perhaps your hospital to respond to a ransomware attack from that respect.
Sure. It's actually something I think every hospital needs to individually walk through in advance.
Right.
They really need to do at least a tabletop scenario to actually figure out how they're going to respond to a ransomware attack. And it's very important that those exercises involve much more than just IT.
Right.
So at the end of the day, it's not going to be an IT or an InfoSec decision. There are definitely clinical decisions that require the doctors and nurses and other hospital staff to weigh in on. Because as you're mentioning, there's patient care issues there.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes beyond just an IT issue at that point. To add to your point about patient safety and emergency rooms, things like that, yes, it's very critical. Particularly, some things are very time sensitive to diagnose.
Right.
If you have things like a stroke patient come in, one of the things that WannaCry hit particularly hard was radiology equipment in a lot of hospitals.
Right.
Now, if a stroke patient's coming in, you have a certain amount of time to do a CAT scan to diagnose a stroke and give the proper treatment. And if you don't do it within a certain window of time, damage becomes potentially irreversible.
Right.
So any kind of delay of patient care to that kind of scenario has a definite impact on patient care with possible adverse patient outcomes. And it's those kind of things that hospitals really need to think about before an attack happens. They really need to sit down with IT, the clinicians, the biomedical engineers who control the medical devices and maintain them, and really figure out in advance how they would respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
With that being said, most hospitals do have downtime procedures that
right.
they can, you know, base on how to behave if a ransomware attack were to hit. But they should really modify those downtime procedures and think about how to respond if a ransomware attack were actually to occur.
Right. Okay. So it's all about really rehearsing, really understanding what you need to do when something like this happens and having a playbook that you can refer to, right?
Yes, and making sure it involves much more than IT.
Right.
That's the problem I see in a lot of hospitals is they just want to pass off ransomware as an IT issue.
Right.
And it's got to be much more than just an IT issue. It really has to be looked at as a clinical patient care issue.
Right. No, I think that's, again, a very good point that you make. I mean, for me, certainly, when we talk about technology today, it is so integrated into the things that we do that I think to be just referring to a lot of the things that we've just touched on as just being pure IT issues are missing some of the point. It's much more holistic than that, isn't it?
Definitely is.
Let's turn to looking at, again, in a little bit more detail, some of the real estate across the hospital environment. I mean, there must be a vast range of legacy systems that you have to deal with within hospitals, right?
Yes, legacy is always a problem because no one's going to give me a $1 million check to replace an MRI machine simply because it runs Windows XP.
Right.
And that goes for pretty much any hospital going. So legacy systems are going to be a problem for quite some time to come for hospitals. The major security issues for hospitals, one, legacy systems is definitely one of them. Another, in general, for hospitals is a lack of security workforce.
Okay.
If you look at the Health and Human Services Cybersecurity Task Force report they released a couple of years ago, one of their findings was that the majority of U.S. hospitals don't have a single full-time security professional working for them. So for a lot of hospitals, it really is a lack of even having the skills on staff to actually appropriately handle security. That's another very, very common problem. Flat networks are another real issue you see. If you look at a lot of the hospitals that have suffered ransomware attacks, a lot of the hospitals that were taken out by ransomware, one of the common factors tends to be that it's a very flat network mm-hmm. existing in the hospitals. Especially when you combine that flat network with a bunch of legacy devices, it does cause a real problem.
Right. And this issue of skill shortage, where do you find the talent? How do you go about attracting the right level of skills into your area, for instance? Any tips there for people?
One of the big things is to actually become involved in some of your local security groups.
Okay.
Things like OWASP, the Cloud Security Alliance. A lot of those groups have various chapters in different cities.
Mm-hmm.
You can often become involved in that. That's a great way to meet other security professionals who might be looking for a job. Some of the stuff I've done in the past is I've also done a lot of adjunct teaching for
okay.
cybersecurity.
Right.
That also helps well because you can often identify promising students as potential employees, things like that, or interns. So that kind of stuff always helps.
Mm-hmm. And it must be a great environment for, say, an intern to come into. I mean, the amount that they're going to be able to learn, right? Because you've got everything there from legacy through to very specific systems and some of the things you've just been talking about. So a good learning ground, I would imagine.
That's very true. Hospitals do have a diversity of devices that you don't really see in a lot of companies because you do have all the standard, you know, PCs, servers, you have all the IoT, all the operational technologies you see in any company. But
mm-hmm.
on top of that, you do have the medical devices and a lot of other devices.
Any advice that you've got, Chris, for people on how to create a sort of a culture of trust and commitment to best practices? I mean, you've talked, you know, in this particular session already about the need for approaches, about rehearsal, about communication with executives and so on. But any specific advice you've got on how do you go about creating a culture of trust and commitment to best practice within the sort of environment that you work?
Sure. It's somewhat, I guess, a specific healthcare answer, but really involving the clinical departments as well.
Right.
Making it so it's clear to everybody that it's not just an IT issue. Mm-hmm. Because one of the advantages I find is if you actually get them to participate in one of those tabletops or other stuff, then they can actually begin to see that there really are clinical implications to this, that it really is not just an IT issue. Mm-hmm. And the more you get physicians to actually understand that this can have an impact on patient care, the more they're willing to actually help with the efforts and to take part in the efforts and not just consider security an obstacle.
And are they willing to participate, or is there a barrier to that, I mean, that you have to overcome?
A lot of times there can be a barrier, but right. Typically once you overcome the barrier, they're much more willing to become participants. What also helps if you can identify a champion among the medical staff.
Right.
Get one of the doctors, especially in a more senior position if possible, to take an interest in it.
Right.
And that really helps get the support of the other doctors once you see one of them identifies that security is important. And for these particular clinical reasons, it really helps to have somebody who speaks their language get the other doctors on board.
Mm-hmm. I think, Chris, there's been some really good tips in this particular conversation that we've been having. You know, everything from starting small, really understanding your environment, getting the buy-in from executives, particularly like this point you just raised just now about, you know, identifying a champion, somebody that you can work with on the business side, in your instance, on the, you know, the doctors or the clinicians. And that seems to me to be a pretty good practice, irrespective of which business you happen to be working in. Just before we wind up and finish here, are there any other tips that you would share with professionals either in the hospital environment or indeed other businesses that we haven't covered that you think are pretty important for ensuring a cyber secure and cyber resilient environment?
For me, it mostly comes down to constantly test. Don't always assume that you have what works. Because what works today may not work against tomorrow's threats. So you want to constantly be reevaluating your environment against the current set of risks and risks you believe might be future risks, because it's a ever-changing landscape. And if you keep actually testing and assessing your environment, it really goes a long way towards actually keeping yourself secure. And the other thing for a lot of hospitals and other businesses is don't just build for compliance. I think mm-hmm. that's a mistake a lot of organizations make. Compliance and security are not necessarily the same thing.
Right.
And I kind of view organizations who shoot for compliance and nothing else is kind of like going for a D grade in the class.
Right.
Yes, you might check all the boxes so you do pass, but doesn't necessarily mean you're doing a good job. So I'd say much more focus on actually building for a secure environment, and compliance usually happens as you build for security, but right. security may not happen if you just build for compliance.
I think that's a really good point. I think a lot of people as well are being forced down that compliance route, aren't they? All too often when money is scarce, the natural reaction is to go for compliance first. And as I think you rightly point out, that doesn't guarantee security. So far better to try to flip it and go for security and have compliance
yes.
being produced. One of the things that you touched on was, of course, the need to remain current and need to really understand where some of the threats are evolving. And at the ISF, of course, we produce a thing called the Threat Horizon that does tend to look out a couple of years and tries to identify some of the challenges for organizations out there. Where do you get your insights from in terms of some of these emerging threats? How do you remain current?
It's actually a good question, and a good point is I actually read quite a bit. I'm pretty much always reading information security news, other stuff. I go to a lot of information security conferences and other events, both as a speaker and as an attendee, and really learn from my peers, too, what they're experiencing. That's also very valuable, too, is actually having a network of people who work in similar positions at other organizations, because threats they're seeing today, there's a very good chance that's going to be the threats you're seeing tomorrow if you're not seeing them today yourself. So having a network of people to actually speak to, bounce things off, attending events, reading as much news as you can get your hands on, those are all really good ways to stay on top of the current threat landscape.
Yeah, some good tips in there. Chris, that's been really insightful, very, very interesting. Thank you very much indeed for stopping by, sharing some of those insights. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That concludes today's episode. Our thanks to Interfaith Medical Center's Chris Friends for his time and his insights, and as always, to ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin. We'll be back soon with another in-depth interview. And in the meantime, listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate and review it, and share it in your networks. Be sure to visit securityforum.org to join the conversation on our LinkedIn group, to access the show notes, and to download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance relating to this discussion. We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening.